Welcome to Earth Reflections, a podcast by the Network of African Women Environmentalists, NAWE. Your hosts are Michael Onyango and Dr. Sheila Uchibuju.
Welcome, and this is going to be a conversation. And my name is Michael Onyango. I'm a supporter of NAWE. And, you know, we have Sheila here and Bettina. But just before we begin, I'll ask them to each just to introduce themselves so that we can get to know who is in this podcast with us this day. Okay, yeah. So Sheila, you want to go?
Hi, I'm Sheila Uchibuju. I'm a member of NAWE, and I've been there from the very beginning supporting the growth of this vibrant network. And I'm very happy to be sitting here today with my beautiful sister, Professor Bettina Ngweno, who is a professor at UC Davis in the US. And she's going to tell us a little bit about her forthcoming book, Growing Old in a New City. Bettina.
Hi, everybody. This is Bettina Ngweno, and a real pleasure to be here. And thank you for the invitation. And I'm excited to be talking to you about this new book, Growing Old in a New City, which is super personal for me because it's about the city I was born in, Nairobi.
Nairobi, new city, growing old in it. Interesting title.
It's interesting because when I first thought about it, I was driving across the city to get to work. Every day I had to take a new route. I said, this is crazy. How does anyone... I couldn't even recognize the city. You'd suddenly have a roundabout disappear or a road that you used to turn right here, you can't turn right anymore. And so I thought, how does people who've lived in a city a long time get used to this change? How does it get used to it changing rapidly, rapidly? I mean, I went one day, and on the way back, I could not go back the same way.
It sounds like Wayakiwe and what's happening right now.
Yes, exactly.
I'm telling you, you really don't know where you're at, and you don't know what's going on, and, you know, it's just by happenstance that you actually get to where you're getting on time.
And nothing's recognizable.
Yes. NAWE, what's NAWE got to do with this, Sheila?
Well, we are having lots of conversations every month. We've been running a series of webinars during this year of COVID, and it's given us a chance to really delve deeper into specific subjects. So the one of the subjects we wanted to dig into is urban resilience. And being here in Nairobi makes you see that there is a force of a growing city. It's palpable. I only came here in 2009, and between 2009 to here to now, it's a completely different city.
It's
the
really
roads
changed.
Are different. But what I found shocking, I was like, every time they build these roads and we think, oh, things are going to ease up, it just clogs up again. Immediately, you're like, where did these more people come from and more cars? So in a way, it's as if it expands and then chokes up. Expands, chokes up. And there's something exciting about it, but I'm sure there's something problematic about it too. So that's why I'm really interested in this, your forthcoming book, because it looks at what's happening on top, but also looks at what's happening underneath.
And it's exactly that excitement that most people talk about in most African cities, because this is happening. It doesn't matter if this is Douala or Johannesburg or anywhere. And the speed at which African cities are changing are immense. And most people talk about excitement and flexibility, and people adjust to that. And I sat and thought, in particular, I looked at my dad, who was also born in Nairobi, and I thought, gosh, must be kind of tough because so much of the city is unrecognizable. Like, what is the Nairobi you grew up with? And so I thought, what must it be like to grow old in this city that is always new? It is always a future city, a city yet to come. You know, even sometimes you dig up the sidewalk, no one ever complains because, you know, it'll be better in the future whenever that comes, because it often doesn't always come, but it's that notion the city will always be better. It is modern, it is young, it is new.
You said, you know, the top and underneath. Let's go to underneath. What's underneath Nairobi?
So Nairobi is interesting. It's on two different levels. It has this huge height differential from one side of the city to the other. There's 1,000 feet difference between the lowest part of Nairobi and the highest part of Nairobi. And in parts of the city is built on top of volcanic tuff. So it is that sort of compacted volcanic dust, which is porous. So one of the things that's under the city is water. And it comes up every so often.
Oh, that's okay.
Just when you least expect it.
Right.
Okay, so I mean, so that's interesting. They say that there's water under Nairobi. Nairobi means a place of cool waters. So can you link that with Nairobi being the city of cool waters and the volcanic tuff? And you've also said that there's a difference of about 1,000 feet from the highest to lowest point. So typically, what's the highest point and what's the lowest point?
So if you think about it, the highest point would be the areas of Kikuyu, Kabete or Karen. And the lowest points would be the flatlands or the plains. So Wilson Airport, places like Huruma, they end up being on the Eastlands in general, on flatland, and the others are on hills. And Nairobi was also the point of where the plains meet the forest, or the flatland meets the hills. And so you have this differential at the lowest point, like Wilson Airport, 5,500 feet, and if you're hitting Kikuyu at 6,500 feet approximately.
Okay. Sheila, I know you spoke about urban resilience, and I know you spoke that this is something which now is just not doing in Nairobi but across. So are there any other cities, or is there anywhere else that you're cross-referencing with, and why is Nairobi such an interesting place for you as Nawe?
Well, Nawe, we're of course very tied to Nairobi because this was where Nawe was launched and born. And this is where UNEP, the United Nations Environment Programme, the regional office is based. But it is a regional network, but the conversations we've been having, especially this year, have been global. We started a platform called the Earth Science Cafes. So Nawe is very interested in getting people to look at ecosystems restorations during this forthcoming UN decade of UN ecosystems restoration. So, but when you say the word ecosystems, it just sounds really scientific and people get, you know, you lose people quite quickly in that. But where you don't lose people is when you talk about landscapes. Mm-hmm. And so whatever landscape, understanding the landscape, the lay of the land where you are, and what are the effects of climate change on wherever you are. So we are here in Nairobi, in a city, and this is a city that is seen as a green city outside, and it is very green, but it has a lot of pressures. Across the world, especially during the year of COVID, people wanted to live in greener cities because you can only have one walk a day, right, and your respite became nature. And so the importance of green cities, of having green cities that allow people to live better and add to their well-being, has gone right up the list of priorities for people and planners and governments. We think that people can learn a lot from Nairobi in terms of it's still a fairly green, fairly livable city, although there are a lot of pressures on it. And we wanted to think about what are the lessons other cities around the world can learn, sure, from Nairobi, because we need more green cities. That's just a given. And Bettina's book really touches, sure, in that in a very interesting way.
You know, I can see you really want to jump in there. Go right in.
Go right in.
Say what you want to say.
You had mentioned, Michael, that Nairobi means a place of cool waters, right, and fresh,
yes,
waters.
Yes.
But it also had another nickname, mm-hmm, which was Green City in the Sun.
Yes, I remember,
right,
that.
And that actually comes out of the fact that in the 1940s,
yeah,
it was designed as a garden city.
Really?
So this concept of garden cities,
yeah,
come up in the 40s, and different in Britain, and actually in multiple places. And Nairobi, when it became a city in 1950, mm-hmm, it was made a royal charter city under the colonial government, and it was a garden city. And Singapore was very jealous that Nairobi became a city before it and decided to design itself on Nairobi.
Wow.
So that's a really interesting fact. Nowadays,
what?
We're all designing ourselves after Singapore, but at that time,
yeah,
Nairobi was the place to design yourself after. And
yeah,
Singapore is also a garden city. It's one of the things that it characterizes itself today. It even has the airport,
wow,
as a, you know, green airport,
yes,
and all that
I
kind of
that
stuff.
Yes, I love the airport.
So
right,
it's something that we have forgotten.
Yes.
That we were an example.
It's interesting you say that, because I also know that Singapore's initial metro and transport system was actually designed and based on Nairobi's. Would you believe that?
Wow.
Yes, and yes.
That's so fun.
I know, and I mean, and look at us now. So I guess it's interesting. So let's go back. I think let's go back to some of the history, because I think a lot of us and a lot of people have got no clue and no idea on exactly what and how Nairobi was purposed to be. And this is interesting. So let's go back a bit to the Garden City concept and what exactly that meant, or what exactly that was meant to do, and what exactly that has shaped the Nairobi that is today.
There are actually two things that shaped it in interesting ways. So it's the water and the Garden City. Mm-hmm. And the water was so important because it was a stop on the railway. But it was also the first stop you could get fresh water.
Ah.
Because before that it was alkaline, and alkaline water clogs up the steam engines. You can't use it. It was also the first stop where you can get trees, right? So you're crossing plains and you have just like thorn bush, and suddenly you come and look at these big trees up here in, you know, in Nairobi on the hills. So both things just made it the perfect place for a railway. A steam-powered railway to exist.
Yes, yeah.
And so that became one of the reasons of stopping there and building, and it became such a big center. And then this idea of a garden city was a city that actually was laid out with greenery, with lots of trees. I remember as a kid, you would look down any road in Nairobi, you would not be able not to see a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And even I ran into someone recently who was saying nowadays it looks like a cartoon city, and I asked, what does a cartoon city look like? And she said, you know, a city that has no trees. You know, in the cartoons, they're all blocks like New York, basically, idea, with no trees on the road. So that was part of the idea, to have a city that was very green, that had a lot of parks, that had easy access to parks. And we haven't done so well in increasing or maintaining the numbers of parks that we have. We still have quite a number, and there's a lot of greenery in the city. And I think more recently, when we've been building new infrastructure, we've been forgetting that it was a garden city, or that was part of the plan, where we're looking to another kind of Singapore, Dubai, or somewhere that isn't a screen.
So so coming back to water, is Nairobi a water plus city or water deficient in terms of the amount of water that there is for the current residents that are there? Because there's always been these issues that keep coming up. Yes.
Yeah, so water is a big issue in Nairobi, and all of our water comes from somewhere else. Mm. It doesn't rain very much in Nairobi, but nevertheless, in spite of all of our drinking water coming from elsewhere and from nearby dams, and there are about four dams that supply the water for Nairobi, so different part of the city actually gets its water from different dams, and so some parts of Nairobi never miss water, and other parts often miss water, and partly it's the dam, and partly it's the fact that there's a hospital or something attached to your water system, so you're more likely to have water than another. But in spite of the fact that it doesn't have a lot of its own water, it doesn't have big rivers, it's very, very much planned around the rivers, or the infrastructure runs parallel to rivers because it was costly to build bridges over them. And the rivers have, because of the differential in height, dug deep trenches. So it's not like you can just go in and out of them easily. You have a small valley to cross.
Sheila, talking about water, talking about people, you know, people and resources and everything else, let's talk a little bit about the people who live in Nairobi, the human resource. Do they understand their city? I mean, and especially from you as an outsider who occasionally comes in and goes back, and when you reflect on some of the other cities where you've lived or where you live or where you come from, what's your perspective on that?
So I have two perspectives. One in that I was born in Nigeria. I grew up in the UK, London. So London is a big city, and water and how we use water. If you think of the River Thames and how when I was growing up in the UK, our biggest fear all through my primary school years, so this is more than 10 years, was that the Thames would flood. We actually used to have every primary school in the city, you'd have practice of what you would do in case it flooded, because this was a real danger. The city was going to flood. And so we were just waiting for the barrier to be built before we could be safe. So we thought about, you know, how water was going to affect how we live.
Then I come to Nairobi, and regularly when it rains, everything in the city at that time, 2009, just stop. You know, I was in a traffic jam once, like 4 hours, nothing moved. You could not move the city. And I was like, but this is ridiculous. You know, how is this possible? And it happened so regularly that people, and yet it just seemed like no one was thinking about how can, why does this happen? And how can it not, how can it change? And I don't think I've ever really gotten a sense of what that was about until Bettina actually talked to me about her research. In fact, it started with her sending emails and talking. And when she was doing her research, she used to send these dispatches, and she talked about the Nairobi River, and it was just beautiful, lyrical, and you know, she was following her research path, but it was beautifully written. And so I began to understand that underneath this vibrant, bubbling city is are rivers and streams that are just trying to also have their own life, get to the ocean, do their thing, and we are building on top of that. And now I can never lose consciousness of the fact that we are causing problems for Nairobi River, who are now. And the way it was written, because it was written so beautifully, I take very personally, you know, Nairobi River is a woman with sisters who are all trying to meet and get to the ocean.
and they keep getting stopped
because people have built in the street and are trying to look for how they can connect. It's beautiful.
So interesting. And just taking off from that point, so Bettina, you know, Nairobi River is a woman with sisters trying to meet. So what and who's stopping the sisters from meeting? And what is it that we need to be cognizant of, and what is it that we must do? And especially coming back to the title of your book, Growing Old in a New and an Ever-Changing City. So what happens for us in that perspective?
So if I think about it, I think of every drop of water as a potential sister, right?
Yes.
And each drop is trying to find the rest of their family.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the choice of just going back to the land or running around and finding family and joining with others and getting a bigger group and a bigger group and a bigger group until they become a river and they have some power and might and end up in the ocean. And because of this sort of height differential of Nairobi, you have all the many, many rivers. It's like a hand. If you imagine all the fingers being rivers entering into, and then the arm is the bigger river in the end. So it's many little trickles that then become streams, that then become rivers, and then become massive rivers, and then enter the ocean. And they're moving very fast because they're moving downhill. And partly that has laid out the city as it is. And as the city is changing and growing older, but nevertheless becoming newer, mm-hmm. which is a kind of a funny
right.
paradox,
yes, yes.
you know, it's growing old and, mm-hmm. and becoming new. The spaces for which this water to travel become narrower and narrower, and therefore more water in smaller spaces moves faster and more powerfully, and finally decides it's tired of its narrow channel and will move away. And then it takes out the things in its way as it goes down. And if you get more rain from climate change, you'll also take out more as you go.
Great. So for a lot of people who actually live in Nairobi, who know Nairobi, can you mention some of the spots where the river has literally, you know, been blocked, and what has happened, it's actually come back and taken its space?
So one of the best examples is Nakumatt UK. And most people who live in Nairobi will know it was demolished, will know that it was a huge court case, that there was a big fight about it,
yes.
and there was a fight for a number of years, actually. And that was one point. But it wasn't actually the point of Nakumatt UK, but that general area around it, Westgate, Brookside, that general space around there where there used to be a wetland, and now there's a parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be space to absorb that water, and now there's concrete. And there used to be a river or a stream
sure.
that went under Nakumatt UK, but now filled the basement,
mm-hmm.
then took out the road next door. Then, you know, but everywhere along, if you follow that river upstream, the Kibagari River, you'll find that there's concrete, there's new buildings, there's big, very large buildings and very heavy buildings that then push the river into smaller and smaller spaces, and means that the smaller space has to contain the same amount of water,
right?
And it's moving faster.
But interesting. So, okay, there's some proponents of, you know, of urban developers who say that, but why can't we just be like Amsterdam and just continue taking over, taking over all these water spaces and build on it. After all, there's more people, and we need to do that. So what's your response to that?
The main response and first response is Amsterdam is flat. It is so flat that you could roll a penny down that canal, right?
Yeah.
And they don't have to deal with height.
Yes.
And if I, you know, when Sheila was talking, I suddenly had this image of my mind of the city of Cali in Colombia, mm-hmm. and every year the houses that are taken out, they're landslide, they're flood. Actually, not every year, twice a year. Right. And everyone talks about it as if it never happened before, but twice a year, exactly the same. But if you look at Cali, it's built exactly like Nairobi. It has hills that meet a flatland. Mm-hmm. And it's only in the flatland that everyone's houses are getting taken out, because the hills produce this power of water coming. They have much more water than us, but still, it's the same dynamic. So let's not think Amsterdam. I don't know, actually, of a hilly city that has managed this phenomenally well.
Okay.
It's an interesting question. And then why pave it all over? I mean, or take into the sea or something like that? I think there's often a sociological reason. Why didn't the people move instead? Mm-hmm. And the effort, for instance, of the Dutch and places like Suriname to do the same were massive failures. So not all seas are the same. Not all things have the same possibility. Mm-hmm. But also the question, you know, in places like Suriname where they tried that, the Dutch tried it there, they didn't listen to the local people who used to move back from the sea as opposed to move to the sea and then have all your stuff eaten away. Mm-hmm. You know, they lived in land for a reason.
So interesting, now that we're talking about water, and I know we're talking about Nairobi, and I'll go back to your introductory statement where you spoke about your own father.
Yes.
Who, grew up here, and essentially this is home for him. And what's going to happen is that a lot of the so-called young people, quote-unquote, now are going to end up living in Nairobi and never going back mm-hmm. to what was there, what they call the ancestral homes and backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So what is it, and Sheila, this is also to you, what is it that we and they must start doing so that they're able to grow old in a city that actually is enjoyable and it's mm-hmm. livable?
So that's so funny that you asked that, because my dad used to always complain. He would say the problem with city planners is they were not born here.
Mm. Interesting.
They're born in the countryside, so they didn't know two things.
Yes.
He said they didn't know what it meant to be a child in a city, mm-hmm. so there are no provisions for children. Mm. There's no recreation, you know, because if you're in the countryside, go herd the cattle, go do this, go for a walk, go down the beach, whatever, you know. What is provided for that for children here? The idea under a colonial system was workers. Mm-hmm. This city was built for workers. And as soon as you hadn't yet become a worker or ended being a worker, mm-hmm. you needed to leave. Mm. So when you end being a worker, that's the second side that's not provided for, the elderly. How you might live, I'm sure nobody who's blind or infirm can deal with our sidewalks right now, because you have to step up these huge things that are built so the cars won't drive on the sidewalk. But as an elderly person, how do you walk on it?
Yeah.
And I think that I think they might have to change the narrative, and that's why I was so interested in the idea, you know, because you don't see people nowadays. Young children know their grandparents in the city, but when we were kids, our grandparents were not in the city,
that's
right?
True.
And so you didn't know your friend's grandparents because they were in the countryside of different countrysides that you'd have to travel like all around the country to find them. So I think we need to change the narrative, as opposed to saying no one belongs to the city, to really claim it and demand that it's built for us, for the people who are here, not the people who might come. Not just the people who might come, but for the people who are here as well.
Okay, great.
That would be me.
That's true.
Sheila, what's his perspective on that?
Yeah, no, it's so interesting, because I'm meeting Nairobi in a particular place, and because I'm coming from a city like London, for me, Nairobi is still very, very, very young. The possibilities are still very many.
Yes.
And so my experience of it is there's a lot more. See, when I came here, I could see myself growing old here, perhaps more comfortably than I could in London, because it was greener. There's still a sense, it's still a small enough city for you to, in your head, know where things are. still has a sense of community. There's all of those things,
yes.
And yet has all the amenities that you want if you know in a modern to live a modern life. So for me, coming from the West to here, and I think for many expatriates and even other Africans, a lot of Nigerians settle here. It is just a really lovely, livable city. A lot of Nigerians retire here, buy their second homes here, because we can see ourselves growing old here. In ways that we can't in other African cities. It's difficult in the UK. But one aspect that Bettina brought up that I think is so important, it's about really, as we continue to expand, it's very difficult to walk. Recently I had a knee injury and yeah. It was just difficult for me just to take a walk down the road and up the road because it's uneven thing, you know, so the sidewalks are just not great for you to do things like that. So the minute you have disabled people because the environment is what disables people. Yeah. We all have different abilities.
Yes. Yeah.
But if the city disables people, then people can't live within it. Then I don't think you can be a resilient city because, you know, resilience means that allowing people to be able to optimally maximize whatever it is that they've got.
Yeah.
So
give them choices
so that they can contribute and still be part of it, whether they're old, whether they're young, whether they're middle-aged. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a missing link in how it's planned. But you see, I still have a lot. I think there's so many wonderful possibilities for Nairobi. Nairobi has not gone so far down the line that it can't reel back and learn from itself.
Sure. And I'm thinking that there's also a possibility in how we plan in some manner because, you know, often...
Let me stop it there. Do we plan?
yes, we do. We do plan.
And the reason why I say that, with all due respect, and you know, I'm not trying to throw jabs at people. And let me tell you why I say that. And I mean, for me, I remember what I considered to be the decline of Nairobi started when the then second president Moi disbanded then City Hall and started putting commissions in place. And then I remember, when I think his name was. Kongo Kungu, the commissioner who then came in as the chair of the commission, and then we started seeing, you know, all kinds of trash and everything not being collected and everything else, and with absolutely, you know, I'm going back to what your father said. I'm not disrespecting anybody, you know. I said that unfortunately the man grew up around trash, so when you went to his office and you told him we have a trash problem, he could not get you because. He couldn't see what the issue was, what you were complaining about. So when I said, do they plan? And again, I'm going back to what your father said. If you didn't grow up here as a child and you didn't understand what and why some of the things were put into place, and then, you know, for example, when you see all these so-called housing projects that come up, you know, all these so-called high-rise and everything else, I mean, there's an architect who's gone to school. There's actually a planner who's approved it and all these people. So in all respect, I'm actually saying something that the so-called professionals, quote unquote, are the ones who've actually designed, you know, those structures and have actually supervised them and put them there. So that's why I'm saying that, do we really plan? And that's
we do. Yeah. But the plan is not the one we want, perhaps.
Ah, interesting.
Because I do think we have a plan and we have a vision. But that vision is really of... a neoliberal city.
Mm-hmm.
It's a city that, as one planner told, I was at a city planning meeting, one of the big Nairobi master plan meetings, and someone asked a question about why you're putting in a dual carriageway when there are only six houses on that street. And the answer of the planner was, because you in those six houses will not be there when the street is finished. Right? I'm not planning for you. I'm planning for someone else. But who that someone else is a political choice we never argue about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we need the planning. It's not the planners, you tell them, build this kind of city. They're like, okay, I can do it. Because they can.
Mm-hmm.
They have the technical ability. But the vision has to be a politically based one. One where we say, that's not the city we want. Where me who's living there today has to say, okay, I'm out. It's being built for someone else. So where exactly should I be?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's as opposed to, right. Can I be in this city you're planning?
Mm. Yes.
Right, but that's a political choice. And we, as citizens, need to bring it to the table. We as residents of the city need to bring it to the table. We who choose governors or not need to bring that to our ward, to our every time, like, what is the city we're planning and for whom does it exist? But yeah. There's been a policy across all of Africa
right.
of anti-urbanism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So whether it was Tanzania saying, you know, the good worker peasant is the peasant outside in a communist sort
yes.
of a sense,
right.
or if it's us, the good capitalist is the farmer. Mm. There's this notion that our real home is in the countryside
yes.
and no African should be in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so destructive to any kind of thought about planning. As a government policy, whether it's apartheid South Africa or Kenya or Tanzania or Nigeria or Ghana, there's been this anti-urbanism where you don't trust the city person and you don't think they're actually okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they have an idea and they have a reason to be in the city and they're not just there to serve and another purpose. And I think part of that mistrust comes from the fact that cities, people in Nairobi, for instance, are the most diverse spot in Kenya, the least likely to vote for whoever is in power, regardless of who they are. They are the most wealthy.
Yes.
They are the youngest.
Mm.
And all of those things, oddly enough, are seen as negatives. Mm-hmm. Diversity, diverse political views, youth, and wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an interesting combination of what most cities are, and that's why politically they rub against the people in power, usually.
Okay, yeah. Okay, great. So so as we wrap up,
yeah.
Okay, so coming back to, first, I think I'll start with you, Sheila.
Mm-hmm.
Going forward, let's talk, like maybe in the next decade or so. Nawe.
Yes.
What's your involvement in cities?
So the decade of ecosystems restoration starts 2020 and ends in 2030. Now, as you know, 2030 is the goalpost for the SDGs, our 16 sustainable development goals. And so we're saying that without looking at ecosystems, without looking at planetary health, none of those other goals really make sense. It's the basis for which every goal that we have is the health of our planet. So we're doing a lot of work around getting people to understand that it's not a fancy add-on. It's not a middle class activism thing to care about trees. It's actually about sustaining for us to continue to live and then to live well. So that's one thing. But we are very much promoting the idea of green cities, because the fact is, no matter what governments think, we are going to live in cities. Urbanization is a key driver and it's going to continue. And it's not a bad thing, because when you have limited resources, you can maximize resources if you build and allow people to access resources in greater groups. So the problem is not urbanization. The problem is the way that we are urbanizing. And because of what Bettina says, we're not planning. There is a plan, but it's not the plan we want. It's not our plan. And we have to begin to articulate our plan. So we protest about the plans that are there, but perhaps it's not clear what our plan would be.
Mm-hmm.
And what Nawe can support, and we're trying to do in some of our campaigns, Adopt a Landscape is one of the campaigns on our website, if you go on the website, is to get people to first of all say, I adopt a landscape, and my, say, for instance, my landscape is Gigiri. And what's my vision for it in the next 10 years? What would I like to see more of in this landscape? If we can get pockets of individuals, because you can only think within a certain pocket, but we do enough of that, and we'll be able to see it on our website, we'll begin to draw people together in visioning the future, post-SDG futures. And that will perhaps allow us to get to the table with concrete plans and visions for the future that come from us, from our hearts, because we have connected with it. But I'd like, as Bettina wraps up, also for her to say something about a wonderful point she brought up when discussing her book about hydrologically just cities. So we talk a lot about water is the new gold. Mm. And this is a truism in some ways, but it's also true in some places. But how we use water, how we where we have access to it, how it moves, all of those can't we... If we plan better, we can have more hydrologically just cities. And I think it's a wonderful phrase that she coined. And I'd like her to also say something about that.
Thank you. That's really fun. Yes, I think of hydrologically just cities as cities that take sort of like you were saying about landscapes. We can imagine our landscape, but how is it related to someone else's landscape? So it's not just taking our landscape and thinking, okay, this is what we'd like it to look like, but we'd like the effect of our landscape to be positive on someone else's landscape. And water is, because water moves, it connects different landscapes, right? So it moves from one place to another, and it usually carries the benefits and the problems with it. It's like your, you know, your best friend, you're just like, whatever comes, it goes with that, right? So water is such an interesting space of that. And if we think of hydrology, you know, the way we build landscapes, the way we maintain them, it affects the way water moves and the kind of water that ends up somewhere, whether it's polluted or clean, the amount of it, the force of it, the way it might affect buildings and people and everything else downstream. So when we're thinking about hydrologically just cities, we also have to think about heights and differentials and where the water moves, whether it's under the city, it's over the city, it's, you know, through the city, it's taking out the city. But and it's, you know, it's interesting because we talk about cities and there are all sorts of cities also on coastlines that have that same problem. You know, the garbage from somewhere else is ending up on our coast or something like that. So we have to think in this sort of big frame of thinking of a catchment zone of a city. And that catchment zone is a sociological one, it's an ecological one, it's a hydrological one. And the importance of what is coming and where are you in the stream really matters. And to form a city that can be considered just, it has to be a relational one. So that when planning, we can't just plan a nice neighborhood without thinking of what in making it nice, how does that affect the place that isn't so nice, or a neighborhood that's not so nice, how do we improve it and where can that improvement start? And it can sometimes start very far away.
Okay. So thank you both Sheila and Bettina for being here, and for all the people who live in Nairobi who are listening to us. You've got to figure out, if this is your city, how do you own it and what are you doing about it? And if you're going to grow old in it, have you thought about being involved in the planning of what happens so that when you grow old, you're able to live the life that you want within the city? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to a podcast by the Network of African Women Environmentalists, NAWE. Join us every Friday for more moments of reflection about our changing landscape and how you can contribute to restoring our earth. For more information, check our website, nawe.group, and the show notes. Thank you and see you next time.